So I'm thinking of exploring a little bit some of the qualities that in this Ford Foundation, this movement from afflictive mind states such as greed, hatred, sloth, agitation, doubt, which is a classic list, but you know, let's not be so exclusive. Shame, pride, confusion, etc. But this movement from these qualities or states of being, or to the beautiful qualities. So in that movement that we're doing, I wanted to spend a little time looking at some. The list is really long. Some of the beautiful qualities of mind. Actually, in Buddhist psychology, the list of beautiful qualities is much, much bigger than the list of detrimental qualities. So that's feels good, no? Brings hope. One of the first that I... that's how I thought about this first, was just by... experiencing the joy of renunciation. So that's one quality. I start with the less sexy one. I think for many of us, like when we hear renunciation, it doesn't feel so appealing. So, I remember the first time I went on a retreat, the first time I started meditation, it was on a 9 or 10 day retreat in Thailand, and somebody talked about this in the first few days, quoting the Buddha saying, "My heart jumps with joy at the thought of renunciation." I remember hearing that phrase, and it was like very mysterious to me. Like, oh, I would not have put these two together. Like, my heart jumped with joy at the thought of renunciation. It was very intriguing, not off-putting though, like really, like, wow, like, is it a key? Like there's something about it. And I remember at that retreat, there was a monk that was there who at some point, he was a very joyful person. And I remember at some point he took us, I don't know how many, maybe a couple of us, to see his kuti, the little hut where he slept. And I remember he was very joyful, and he showed us his pillow. His pillow was a piece of wood. and you know, between what I had heard, like the theory or the text of like my heart leaps with joy at the thought of renunciation, and here, him very joyfully showing us his heart with, you know, and his pillow with joy, you know, like, this is where I sleep, this is my pillow. and I was like, wow, him too, you know, that makes two of them, you know. They're onto something. I want to find this out. There's something about it. And... yeah, and through practice, discovering for myself, you know, that there's beauty in simplicity, you know, in renouncing some, and you know, you could say that the whole path is a path of renunciation, but it's important to understand that what we let go of, abandon, renunciate, that we practice renunciation about, is what hinders well-being. It's the letting go of what is in the way, what is obstructing wellness, peace. In line with this, I remember hearing about this practice of sense restraint. That's also another one that doesn't seem so sexy, you know, like sense restraint. Like restrain your senses. And hearing this, I remember thinking, like, oh, I'm not sure it's for me. but there's other practices that I can work with. But sense restraint, like, you know, seems like going against delight and beauty. And but practicing on retreat, I discovered, you know, like I would do walking meditation. And it was just be stepping, stepping, you know. And at some point, let's say I reach the end of the path, I stop and I look up. And then I see somebody doing something else than what we're supposed to do, you know. I'm like, what are they doing, you know? And then suddenly I'm taking off my research because I'm bugged by beings, you know. And like, why were they doing this? Like, why were we all supposed to do this? Like, I'm doing this. And then, you know, like, and or, you know, I would walk, stop, and look, and I would see somebody. And then I was like, oh, how do I look? What do they think of me? You know, and then I would lose balance, and you know, and I, at some point I noticed, like, oh, Pascal, when you look, you see stuff. You know, and it becomes like suddenly, like the papancha kicks in. You know, like why did I? And at some point, I very like naturally discovered for myself, like, oh, maybe I'll keep the gaze down. You know, and I'll just stay, make it simple for myself. You know. And discovering, like, oh, that's helpful. Like, it's not like renounce, don't look up, you know, but I actually am not going to look up to make it more simple for myself, because then I'll get attached to what I see and I'll be constructing. And so, but I, you know, that's a self-discovery. I don't want anybody to sign up for this. After it got more refined, my understanding of sense restraint, now the way I understand it is restraining myself to the sense contact. So it means staying very close to this, hearing the bird, just hearing. Not like what I renounce is the embellishment, the story. It's just, oh, hearing. Instead of like, oh, you know, it's just spring and the winter will be back, you know, and the bird sing, songbird, you know. This, I'm renouncing this for the simplicity of just maybe the joy of the sound. And so, anyway, that's the exploration for me of a renunciation. And, you know, there's many ways to talk about this, but just to put it there. And I remember hearing Sylvia Borstein talk about this, and she would say about papancha, like when the mind takes on something and kind of runs with it, with its, you know, creative in its creative ways. And I remember she said she would take this mental note in her mind. She would say, don't pick this up. Don't pick this up. And then she would add, but most of the time what I would have to do is more like, put this down. Put this down. Because she would pick it up, you know, with an opinion and a preference and a anticipation and what if and conjectures or whatever it's called, you know, like possibilities, and then put this down. But it's harder to put something down once we've picked it up. So that's part of the practice, is this. And, you know, I've heard her say this maybe 20 years ago, and it, you know, and often I've, oh, when I think about it, it's usually too late. You know, I'm like, oh yeah, but don't pick this up. Well, I have now, like, and because, you know, what I've noticed for myself, like if I'm sitting here and then association of my, something happened, you know, something heard, something felt, and then the memory of some association, and then suddenly I pick up some drama, you know, like I invent it if I have to, it's not a problem. But then when I do this, I notice it's a whole loop, you know, like I cannot just put it down, like I, like somehow, like it's going to take me on a ride, you know? And then I'll have to forgive the person who didn't say what I thought they could say one day, you know? And I have to forgive myself for having been angry at them for saying something they didn't say but could have said, you know? And it's energivore. It takes a lot of attention and energy. And so, you know, when the best version of this is, I'll be sitting here and the mind will be about to pick up something, you know, like I'll feel the kind of the intention, the warmth, you know, the energy, like, you know, about to express an opinion or have an opinion, and the best version would be like, just stay with the breath. It's easier this way to just not, you know, create a kind of a self who wants to something, you know. So anyway, an exploration, part of what we're doing is an exploration of renunciation. What is good to actually put down or not entertain? At the time of the Buddha, there's an exchange that where somebody says, it's something like this. So this person says to the Buddha, you know, I've been listening to you now, like what your instruction and whatnot, you know, and what you're suggesting, you know, for us human beings, we delight in kind of drama, you know, we delight in storytelling, we delight in scatteredness, you know, thinking about this and that and what if, you know, and for us human beings, we, like, your path seems like a sheer drop. That's the, like an abyss, you know? And the Buddha says, yeah, for those who don't know, you know, what is for them delightful, for the wise one, is not delightful. And what is delightful for the wise one is not delightful for the one who doesn't know better, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's, it's pretty impressive to say, like, one who doesn't understand delights in what is not delectable, you know, what is maybe more, don't want to be too dramatic, but dangerous in a way, you know, leading to suffering. And we don't have to believe any of this, but here in the silence and the comings and goings of the body and the mind, I think we can discover some of this, you know. So renunciation. Also in this movement from the afflictive mind states or hindrances, what hinders well-being or peace or freedom, moving towards the beautiful qualities, there are the seven factors of awakening. And you might know them, and it's good. And it's good also to bring them back here. Because, speech is a very powerful thing. Huh? It says, in the mouth we have an axe. With an axe you can destroy stuff. And with an axe also you can build a refuge. And it says that giving airtime to these qualities, you know, so speaking about them, reflecting, collectively invoking them, and inviting them, talking about them, is one of the ways to develop them, to give them value. To and in the text, it's really interesting how there's a couple of times, at least two times that I know of, where somebody, it's touching to just think about this, somebody's sick, they're physically sick. And in one case, it's not the Buddha, it's somebody else, maybe Sariputra, or I don't remember who, but somebody else. And in one case, it's the Buddha, and they go visit somebody who's sick, and so they, you know, like we do, they get some news. It's the same construction in the two different moments. So the Buddha would say, like, hey, how are you? Are you getting better? Do you feel better? And the person says, actually, no, I'm not. It's getting worse. You know? So they're reporting on what's happening. And the Buddha's like, are the symptoms or the sensations getting less painful? And the person's like, actually, no, they're getting worse. You know, right now, that's what is happening. And they have a little exchange. And then in both cases, the Buddha talks about the factors of awakening, and it says it's a good thing to do, to talk about the beautiful qualities of mind to somebody who's sick, or it's a powerful thing to do. It's intriguing to me. So the factors themselves. I want to talk about this now because I think that it's maybe things that we're exploring or could invite, could reflect on, could see, you know, like how, what is that for me? Because here's going to be like pointing to experiences, you know, mind states, qualities of mind. It's concepts, it's words, but what is it for me? What do I know this? Have I experienced this today, this week, or in my life? Sometimes the mind, not always, but sometimes the mind gets a little bit more pliable. That's what we do in practice, is we're practicing to make the mind more flexible, supple, so that, we go from a rigid mind, this is how it is, and it should be like this, you know, to a mind that can say, okay, that's not happening how I foresaw it, you know, what can we do now? So the flexibility of mind, it's a beautiful quality. And as we practice here, it's possible, maybe it's not linear like this, you know, but as we practice, it would be fitting, it would make sense that our mind would get a little bit more pliable than on the first day when we arrived. And the pliability of mind means that we can sometimes invite an attitude or something, and we can gain access to it. It might not be there, and maybe we'll just remember, oh, maybe kindness would be good. And as we think of it, it shows up. When the mind is not supple like this, we'll say, oh, I'm a little harsh with myself, maybe kindness. No. You know, like it's not going to come. You know, the mind doesn't have that pliability. But it's possible that we gain here a little pliability of mind so that, the mind can move like this from, appreciating what is can be appreciated, and also, you know, touch on what is more difficult and be able to touch it. And it's not kind of like just stuck in the drama. It can, it's difficult. And if there's a little humor possible, it can laugh a little bit and then return, not deny what is there. Do you see this how helpful it is in life? You know, so for example, here we can do serious work and crack a joke. You know, they're not exclusive, you know. And that flexibility is really good for learning. It's really good for... And so at this point, there might be some flexibility of mind. And just talking about these qualities might be a way for us to invite them in. Or we'll just kind of stuck the information. And then when we go back to silence, we'll start walking and maybe see for ourselves, what could that be? Is it there? Can it be invited? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that might be what is meant by this word or this description that Pascal gave. And so so these qualities, the Buddha talks about it, and I love the images, and the text is so, there's such good images. So sometimes I have to choose between, so this is the, I'll tell you both. If unable to choose, you can read it, Pascal. I mean, they're the same, but it's just so delightful. And so sometimes the Buddha talks about, or at one time at least, he talks about the river Ganges. And he's saying, you know, the Ganges, le Gange. Do you put an S in English? Ganges. The Ganges. S? Okay, we'll go for S today. I'm so sorry. So it says, the same way that the Ganges flows to the east, inclines to the east, and he has many verbs he uses, you know, to, you know, really make it really clear that it's going eastward, you know? Like the same way that the... So that I don't know if you can see it on the map, how it goes from, you know, the mountains of the Himalaya, maybe, I don't know exactly, but middle of India, and then it goes towards Calcutta in this way. And he says, in the same way that the Ganges inclined to the east, is flowing to the east, and in the same way, one who brings attention, brings mindfulness, when there is mindfulness, very naturally the mind will incline, the mind will flow, the mind will go towards curiosity. When there is attention, I use that word, these words, when there is presence, mindfulness, we come close to something, in the contact, in the very generous contact or careful attention, for sure interest will emerge. It's very natural. In the same way that the Ganges is flowing to the east, you know, like you cannot make it go west. You know, it's just not natural. That's not what it does. It naturally flows. If one brings attention, naturally there will be curiosity that will arise. When there is curiosity, naturally it will be energizing for the system. That's what it does. Curiosity is energizing. So naturally there will be energy. When there is mindfulness, curiosity, and energy, as sure as the Ganges flows to the east, in the same way there will be joy will arise. And when there is joy arising, in the same as sure as the Ganges will always flow to the east, in the same way calm will arise. When the body, the mind has joy, is suffused with joy, it calms down. This calm, tranquility will arise. And when there's tranquility, gatheredness, concentration, the mind will not be scattered anymore. If it's joyful and quiet, it will be gathered. It's very natural. In the same way that this is natural, that will come together, when there is gathering, there will be also balance. The mind will become balanced. It will become equanimous. It won't be reactive and, you know, like you say a little something, why, you know. Like if it's calm and it's joyful and curious, it will, and gathered, it will naturally be balanced. And when the mind is mindful, curious, energized, joyful, quiet, gathered, and balanced, naturally it will gain insight. It will understand better what is happening. And naturally, it will be liberating. This understanding will liberate the mind from confusion. That's how the Ganges flows. And that's how this practice works. The other image that he used is the image of the rain falling in the mountain. And so he'll say this. In the same way that when it rains in the mountain, it's very natural for the drops of water to fall down, mindfulness. Naturally, the water will come down the slope of the mountain. Very naturally, it will join a little spring, which will join a river, which will join the Ganges or the Saint Laurent. And naturally, it will lead to the ocean. That's very natural. So when we bring this mindfulness, naturally, there will be at some point there will be the cultivation of curiosity, which will be energizing. So this is the seven factors. It's nice to hear, no? Mm-hmm. And you might check in and it's like, well, it's not exactly the course it's taking for me. But, you know, as we know, when the water falls, you know, in the mountain, you know, it goes through, hits rocks, and, and you know, before it gets to the ocean, there's a whole path there. And it also, we can see this maybe over a longer period of time when there's the cultivation of mindfulness. Or maybe just in a tiny bit, in a tiny moment, you know. As I, you know, when I said the other day, like, if we get interested in the lamp, you know, something's going to stand out. You know, we'll probably get interested in how does the light reflects, and etc. There's natural, when we come close to something, you know, something will be revealed. And it will spark curiosity. And so here, we're playing with this conditionality, one thing leading to the other. So there's other ways that, you know, that how suffering happens is also like this, in the same way, you know. We could create change of conditions, you know, like figure out change of condition that leads to suffering, despair. And so these qualities, now I just presented them in a linear way or a cause and effect way, but they could be presented in a sisa way. Yeah, is that? Yeah. And so seven factors, so three calming factors, three energizing factors, for a total of seven. Just checking, keeping the listener alert. And so in this image of the sisa, mindfulness is at the center, it's at the hinge point, yeah. And on one side we have three calming factor, and on the other side three energizing factor. And so the three energizing factor are curiosity, or the real word in Pali is Dhamma Vichaya, which means investigation of phenomena, the staying close to the phenomena, the watching how something behaves, what is hearing, what is stepping, what is a taste, what is crunchy when suddenly it becomes smoothy or something like this. So the curiosity, I call it curiosity for simplicity here. So the energizing factor are curiosity, energy itself, and joy. They're calming, they're energizing factor in the mind, factors. And the calming factors are calm, tranquility, gatheredness of mind or concentration, and equanimity. These are calming factors in the mind. And the art of practice is the cultivation of all these qualities, but the balancing of them. So, if you're practicing and you're saying, oh, Pascal, it gets really, really, really quiet, I'm really there, my mind is not scattered, I'm just there with the breath or with the silence. And then I start to talk with whales or ducks, it becomes a little dreamy, like this imagery. The calming factors are really present, but they're not met by the energizing factors. So we need to bring the energizing factors so that there is, a vivacité, there's intelligence there. And in the same way, if you're like, oh, I keep thinking about everything you said this morning and now this, and I want to see it. And I was like, okay, a lot of energy. We need to bring the calming factors in here because there's not going to be discoveries. The mind is too quick. It's going too fast. It's not actually landing. It is unable to feel, touch, experience. And so the art of practice is to... And why is mindfulness there in the center? Because it's the one that will notice the disbalance. It's mindfulness that will be, oh, we're a little too quiet here. We're getting a little dumb, Or, yes, there's a lot of desire for understanding, and it's not balanced with calm, so we won't be able to find answers here. And so we play a little bit with this. This is what we're doing. And I'm naming this because this is what we're doing, maybe unknowingly. And it could be good to maybe use that frame of reference, this teaching, as we're practicing walking or during the meal. So can I invite some amount of calm? And it might be available if I orient the mind in this way. And sometimes not. It's not available. There's just agitation. But it might be possible to say, hey, Pascal, could we bring one measure of calm here just to see what would happen? And it might be through slowing down, Maybe I'm there serving my food, like, oh my God, there's a whole line behind, and, there's so many choice, and all this. And I'm like, okay, let's feel the body, take a breath, Just reach for some lado, and feel it, and pour, that's okay. And I like this teaching a lot. I give it often because for me it's very central to my practice. That's one of the ways I understand practice. In a formal way, when sitting and walking, these things are important. They're also important to me when I'm teaching, when I'm meeting people. That's one of the ways that the teacher will assess what's happening. You know, could we bring some of these? Which one is missing? Like that. But also as a practitioner in daily life, as a human being, as a neighbor, as a partner, an email answerer, these are things that will help me a lot. You know, if there is a conflict, they're my best friends. You know, if there is something that is not going my way, if I can remember them and invite them in, they'll be my best friend and the best friend of the person on the other side of the conflict too. You know, a measure of calm, a measure of curiosity. Like, push a little bit the opinions and it should have been like this, and let's bring a little curiosity, a little calm, and probably we'll find some information that we're not aware of. Or, you know, maybe we'll have access to more creativity around what's happening. You know? And so again, it's a way to... Sorry? Not sorry to you. I had a teacher, I remember as a kid, he was in the primary school. He was doing mathematics. There was a big board, and he was like... walking, and he would always end up knocking the garbage can, and he would say, sorry. He would get back into his... equations. So, calm. Inviting the cosmic factors. You can see the tendency now of this mind. It's easily energized. And, yes, I was about to say something. Yeah, anyway, in daily life, they can be very useful, these qualities. If I want to learn something, you know, fix something, prepare something, you know, offer the best of me to a friend, you know, something like this. These qualities are welcome. 7 is too much for me in daily life. But 2 is good. It's something I can work with. So I often think, a measure of calm, a measure of curiosity might be helpful here. You know, could we bring this? And if there's something I really don't want to do, like, oh no, I have to do this again, well, could we invite some curiosity about this, some calm? And whoops, maybe it'll be less painful to accomplish, to do. So they're useful in life, but they're, as I said earlier, they're actually what's needed for insight. So insight, understanding, is conditional. It needs some inner conditions, qualities. And so here, we're developing these qualities. Even if we didn't talk about them up to now, in this way at least, that's what we're doing. That's what's happening. And maybe to say a few words about calm and concentration, particularly, just to know that, but what are they? What how does it feel? And maybe you don't have that question because you have a reference. You know what calm or tranquility feels like. But we could say one thing that I've observed is that when there is the factor, some amount of calm or tranquility is a word that is used, the mind has less to say. The mind has less to say. You know, an image that is used is of a lake, calm lake. You know, where there's no ripple at the surface of the lake, and that's how, you know, the mind can feel, where it's there with the silence, the breath, the bird songs, and as I was saying earlier, you know, like using the image of the cake, these are the different ingredients that come together and gives this taste. So sometimes it, you know, it can be useful to think of calm and to think of concentration, but in the actual experience, they come together, you know. And sometimes we have that in nature, you know. These factors kind of come together. We're just there with the cedar grove or in the cedar grove, you know. And in a way, et voilà, there's nothing to say. But if we look more like theoretically, what is actually happening is that there's a very simple, you would say, presence where there's vibrancy, you know. We're not sleeping, we're awake to the natural world. And there's joy, there's a kind of contentment or appreciation, no? There's something, we feel somewhat lucky to be there. I'm already putting too many words. It's an experience. Huh? Mm-hmm. And so there's just being there. There's no problem of energy, you know, too little energy or too much energy. There's just being there. It might happen through sewing, knitting, doing sport. It can happen in many different situations. But nature is something that many of us can relate, like different moments in nature, by beach or here. So there's energy. The mind is engaged with what is there, is in contact. The mind is gathered. It's not scattered, you know. It's very different if we're, you know, we know that too, you know, like, oh my God, it's so beautiful, it's so beautiful, where's my camera? I wish this person was there. This is very different than, wow, you know. The mind is gathered, it's quiet, it's in intimacy with what is happening. And it's balance. It's balance. So these things are very natural to a human being. And sometimes, whoops, they're not there anymore. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu in the south of Thailand, in the rural area where he was teaching this to the farmers and was saying, like, hey, that's all stuff you know. Like, it's not like when you're actually plowing the land, you know, preparing the land to put seeds, or you need these qualities. You need, otherwise, you know, it's going to be way too painful. You need to be engaged with what you're doing. So, and when you hit the rock, you know, with the plow or whatever the tool is, you know, you can't lose it. You're going to get exhausted. You know, you have to calmly, you know, just move the rock. And so there has to be equanimity. There has to be concentration. There has to be some level of calm. And if you enjoy your work, you know, that's going to make the day better, you know. And so you know these things. They exist in our lives. So just to not make them like, oh, out there, you know, no, that's part of who we are also. Concentration is also the kind of staying power, that we stay. We could stay with the same object. We were talking about this in one of the small groups. There's a kind of concentration that is one-pointed, where you'll be with the nostril, the air coming in and out of the nostril, and you'll stay just there for 20 minutes, an hour, just right there. Push in, out, in, out. So it's very one-pointed concentration, very focused. We know that from maybe work sometimes or different situation. And there's another kind of concentration that is more like this. It's open. I'm present, but the objects of attention keep changing. So I'm here, I feel the sensations in my right leg, I'm aware of seeing, hear the sounds, feel the breath. I'm always here, I'm not scattered. I'm here, I'm here, you know. And at some point, whoops, I'm not here anymore. I got caught in some thoughts. So there's a way that we can be concentrated and, you know, like we are in life. Sometimes you're in a meeting and, you know, you keep the agenda going. You know, we have to talk about this. You check the time. You make sure that this person is heard. And, you know, like there's different things going on and we're here. And so concentration is several moments of presence stuck together, you could say. A staying power. When we start the retreat, we say, oh, let's be attentive. Let's, the guard, bring the to the queen or something. So we put mindfulness as a value like this. And suddenly we start thinking like, oh, how many retreats have I done yet? You know, or oh, I should have started earlier. And we have to bring back the attention to, hold on. Here, what's happening here? No? And then it goes some kind of concern. I wonder what this person, this or that, you know, like, oh. And we keep slipping like this. And we have to kind of put an effort to come back. And there's a moment, a few moments here and there maybe, where there's a reversal of the ball like this, where suddenly this becomes a default setting, the being present. Mm. So there's a few steps where we don't have to effort it. It's just a way to be for a few steps. Or while we hear the bird, or through a few chewing, you know. It's like just there with the sounds in the dining room or with the taste, you know. And it's very natural. It's very simple. I like this image from Joseph because here what happens is we get protected. The mind is protected for a little while. It could be a lifestyle. It's possible. But in this, the protection here is that there's presence here. It's a mindful presence. Actually, Gil Fronsdal says, you know, this is mindfulness. This is awareness. There's not the effort part. It's a way to be for a few moments or a few hours. And when there is this, what cannot come in is desire for something else. It wouldn't even cross the mind to want something else because this is plenty. We're just here with this, with this step, with this bite, with this breath. And so in this moment, that, you know, mental quality cannot come in. Or the not wanting what is there, the opposite. Wanting to get rid wouldn't come. And people will describe this. We can very much experience this while having pain in the knee. It's not just with flowers and birds, you know. It can be, you know, just here. And I'm just here, feeling this. It's exactly like this. The mind is equanimous. It's not positioning like, why is it happening? It's just, wow, really throbbing or piercing. You know? It's not something I would call pleasant. But the mind doesn't want something else. It's just there, touching this. There's no problem of energy. I have to meet this. It's just natural to. There's just enough energy to be with what is there. You know, not too much energy, not too little energy, and no doubt. Like, am I doing this right? Am I doing this right? No, it's just, here it is. You know, it's pulsating strongly here, and there's an experience of that. And this is something that we can cultivate so much so that we can bring it in life. Actually, we do sometimes, you know. And could look like nothing, it's not much, but it's very healthy. It's a really good way to live, you know, instead of always being in preferences and expectations and trying to get something and get away from something, to actually be with this. It's, it's an impressive way to live. Especially here we slow down, and if we get to experience it consciously, we'll start to give it value, you know. As in life, maybe we notice more the drama than when the mind is non-reactive in this way, engaged, but not... Yeah, and to we could stop there. That could be enough. End. Maybe just to say a little bit. You know what I talked about earlier? Things not being personal, or this really intriguing Buddhist teaching. So to do that investigation, we would need some of these qualities to be gathered, you know, enough calm, enough to become interested in, you know, looking at who is this I that seems to start every thought, you know, I will do this, I will think, I don't agree with this, I prefer that, you know, this I that we keep referring to investigate this, it'll need these qualities, that calm and that curiosity. You know, if there's agitation and scatteredness, of course we'll be in the storytelling, you know, we'll be telling the story of self, and will I get there, and, you know, I invested a lot of time in this retreat, I better get home, back home with something, you know, and so... Here we're not questioning self, we're assuming self and building, you know, embellishing or worsening from there, you know. And it's an amazing thing to do, to be able to actually say, hold on. What is this? Can I find this thing that I'm scared for and that I... You know, like, what is actually this that seems to be at the kind of suck, the ground that everything is built on, you know, everything. So it needs some calm to be able to... to explore this, and it can be through, you know, the feeling tone. We talked about this, you know, and to actually, let's start with. I think hearing is a good entryway for this. If the mind has some calm and curiosity, you know, both energized and calm, I think one of the entry point for this research could be just hearing. So in hearing a bird, for example, we get plenty of this here. Notice how the hearing happens by itself. You know, it's just something very natural. So I'm not the song, I'm not the bird song. This I know, I'm not that. That is outside, it's away over there. So I'm not that, and I can become interested in the knowing. So for us, when this has been unlooked, uninvestigated, it appears like me. Come on, Pascal. Clearly, I'm the observer or the witness. And with just a little calm, with just a little curiosity, not falling asleep, but calm and awake, through hearing, I think, is the best door that I would think of. We can notice that hearing happens by itself. Like, there's a sound, and it's known. Do you see a little bit? But it's better to play with it and see. There's a sound, and the sound is known. I don't have to exert a certain eye or something. It's just something very, very natural that happens. There's a sound. If there's a sound, it'll be known. And And so in this investigation, we start to dive underneath assumptions and we go explore the nature of reality. And we might discover that in the same way that the sound is not me, the knowing also is not me. The sound happens. We can say that it happens. And the knowing of the sound happens. And so what we're doing is we're deconstructing. It's a different view of reality. We're going to see the building blocks of reality. What is it actually made of? Does the I make it to the common denominators, to the what's really there, you know? Or is it an interpretation, a construction, a conceiving? The Buddha talks about this. I am. This is a conceived idea. I was. This is a conceived idea. I will be. This is a conceived idea. Conceived ideas are a boil, a dart, something else. There's a few images there. And so, just noticing that, starting to investigate the knowing quality. So not the thing, not the itching, but what knows it. Not the sound, but what illuminates it. It's very defective, the words I'm going to use here, but what reveals, not the thought, but what hears it or knows it. So the factor, this element of consciousness, is something really worthy of investigation. We could live a whole life without questioning it, but it seems that identification seems to be related to suffering, to stress, to fear, to feeling separated, to a lot of our... And on the path, we want to bring these factors together because they will help us in our relationship, they will help us in times of conflict to learn stuff, and there will be what are needed. These qualities that we can get very subtle, go and question something that nobody has questioned, or almost nobody. There's a whole lineage of people who have since 2,500 years. But who is this? Who is this? You know, what is this? The Buddha, for example, for the body, uses the image of foam. Foam, kind of pointing to, it's his way to use an image to express what he's discovered for himself, is that the body is constantly changing form, like the foam by the ocean, you know, like with every wave, like this, like that, like this. And if we pay attention here, we'll see that what I think of as solid and mine is actually stretching in this, like that, in movement, still bloated, although, you know, all the different versions of it, it's constantly changing. And to become really aware, knowledgeable, I don't know how to say, to vipassana, to know that this is totally dynamic matter, you know, will release some of the fear of change, you know, and aging and death, you know. And it's like, no, actually, it's been changing the whole time. And the image of the foam also, it's saying, it's pointing to empty of a self. There's nothing I, enduring, essential I in that. The body is a bunch of things happening, conditions playing out, cold, warm, stiff, fluid, etc. All these things constantly changing. Nothing absolutely, essentially I in there. Empty, like foam. And he uses the image of the bubble that I talked about for feeling tone. And the pleasure, we might think, not having investigated, we might think, this is mine, it's mine. It's pleasure is happening. It's my pleasure. It's my displeasure that I feel, you know. And the more quiet we'll be and attentive, we'll notice that it's conditional. You know, it takes, you know, it takes cow for joy to, for pleasure to arise. It takes the sight of cow, like it's not exactly mine. It does happen. We're not negating this. It's one of the building blocks of reality. So one of the building blocks of reality is matter. There's really matter. It's not imagined. Mm-hmm. There is really hardness, softness, pushing, pressing, tingling. These things really happen. There's really enjoyment, gratification, delight, you know, like pleasure is really an experience that happens. Displeasure also, it's not invented. It's felt. It's true. But bubble, there's no I in the middle of that. There's no I doesn't reside there. We have to go check this out for ourselves. And the Buddha keeps going. Okay, it's not in the body. I can understand that. It's not pleasure. Pleasure comes and goes. It's not me. And it's like, okay, let's try something else. Let's try, maybe I'll go towards, you know, the fabrications of mind, the papancha, the thoughts. Maybe let's just put this way, the thoughts, thinking. While I'm thinking, well, let's get quiet and curious and let's see. And we're probably going to discover that a lot of the thoughts are not exactly me. You know, they come from education, from circumstances, from, you know, they're not exactly... Like, I was just thinking of the fridge story, you know. Like, for greed to arise, for snack, greed for snack, needed a white box. You know, without the white box, that it would not have arisen. And the greed, we could say it's me, but no, it's a dormant quality, it's a tendency of mine, it's dormant, always on the lookout for an opportunity to attach itself to something. You don't have to give it much, give it a little patch of white in the kitchen, you know, and it'll, let's get something out of this, you know. Greed is this dormant quality, and it will latch on anything. You know, you'll just be surfing on the web and need this, or you'll see some need that, like, and it will present to you or to me that something really satisfying is on the other side of that. You know? That's its job. Its job is delusion. It's to say, like, wow, that's going to be really satisfying. It's projecting satisfaction. It's on the outlook. It's just waiting for an opportunity. So is aversion. You know, it's just looking for an opportunity, you know, and feel a little something, self-hatred, just looking for an opportunity, you know. Give it a little something and it will hate you for it. You know? I remember one time I was in line to serve food at a retreat, and the forks, knives and stuff like this, they were kind of just the handle was sticking out. They were vertical and you couldn't see the... So there's a soup, so I get my soup, and at the end there's all these utensils. Yeah, is that the way you call it? And so I pick a spoon for my soup, and it happens to be a serving spoon. So it's really big spoon. I didn't know, I could not have known. There was just a handle. I grab one of the spoon. It's a huge spoon, and suddenly I'm totally ashamed. You greedy pig. You know, like this is what lands in my mind. I was so, because of mindfulness prior, you know, because of the days prior, I didn't fall, I was not duped or fooled by it. Like how's that, you know? Wow, this tendency for self-hatred and blaming will latch on anything. You know, give it a big spoon that you didn't even choose. It doesn't matter. You're a greedy bastard. You know? And so, do you see the potential of liberation in there? Like, if I'm aware of this, then it becomes funny or tender. Like, oh my God, that's what this mind does to itself. It's so abusive, you know. It will latch on anything to blame, you know. So, and when we watch this, we see it's not personal. It needed the spoon. The tendency has been built in there in some way, imprinted. I've heard this verb this week here. And it just does what it does, you know. And for this, the Buddha used the image of the banana tree trunk, as many of you know. So how it works is, and I'll finish with this. Imagine somebody who wants to build a refuge. They want to build a refuge, something solid that you can count on. You can. So they take their axe and they go in the woods to look for hardwood, like really strong wood to build a good shelter. And in the middle of the cedar grove over there, they see a banana tree. And they see the big leaves, huge flowers, huge fruits, very generous. They're like, oh my God, of course, in the middle of this, there's really hard wood, you know, for sure, I can count on that one, you know. There's no other tree that has big leaves like this, big fruits like this. It's the biggest. Let's go for it. The hardwood is in there. Start axing the banana tree to find fiber. It's a, you know, it's a graminée. It's herbs. It's a, not a herbs in English, but in French. There's nothing to it. There's nothing you can count on to build something solid there, you know. And so the Buddha used the image of the banana tree trunk, empty. And he's saying, your thoughts, you cannot count on them. And there's no I in the middle of them. There's no I making them. It's empty in its core. It looks solid. It looks dependable. You know, I can count on this. You know, I'll think about it and I'll figure it out, you know. And there's something, it's not going to be the absolute refuge, you know. You're not going to get it from that. And there's no I in the core of that. We don't want to believe this. That would not be the thing to do. We want to go check it out. That's why we come on retreat, so we can see these concerns. So, I will do this, I will do that. It looks very solid. The I looks very solid. And when you start axing this with your mindfulness, you know, you might discover that the I that it keeps referring to is just conception, conceiving. But there is thoughts. There are thoughts. They're there. They come. They go. But there might not be an I behind so much, but more play of conditions. And more to come. Okay, so let's just let these words dissolve for a moment. May these qualities, factors of awakening, may they be developed in beings for their own protection, for their well-being, for their relationships, and for their awakening. May these qualities grow in us, and in our sanghas. In our collective effort. May they lead to liberation. Thank you again for your listening, you're considering. this stuff. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.